we could very easily find ourselves with the Russians deciding to attack all NATO military targets inside of Ukraine. And I, up to this point, they've really shied away from trying to inflict casualties on NATO. I think that's going to disappear. Now, they're going to inflict casualties. Possibility that they could strike outside of Ukrainian territory.
Larry Johnson, good morning to you.
Hi there.
Nice to have you on, and I wish it was under different circumstances. Kyiv is lobbing or lobs some missiles at Russia, and Russia lobs some missiles back. I want to talk about that. What's the motivation here? This should be winding down, and it seems like it's winding up. Is the Biden-Harris administration trying to start a World War III here?
Yeah, I think the, look, the United States had provided ATACMS missiles starting in the fall of 2023. So this is not new. They'd provided those had a range of 100 miles. Then in March of 2024, the Biden administration provided the longer range version that goes up outward to about 200 miles, about double the distance. Throughout that period, Ukraine has fired these, but mostly at Russian targets inside of the Ukrainian boundaries. And Russia's been able to defeat them. There's been this propaganda meme from the Ukrainian side that they want to be able to launch farther strikes deeper inside Russia, thinking that that will bring about a change in the war. But even U.S. officials, when this decision was announced on Sunday, or released on Sunday, conceded that it's not going to make a damn bit of difference to the war. It's not going to weaken Russia. It's not going to destroy Russian military capabilities. It's not going to enhance Ukraine's ability to turn the war around. It's more of like a, poke in the eye to the Russians. The Russians have made clear up to this point, they've been willing to tolerate U.S.-backed attacks inside Ukrainian territory, and even in Crimea, which Russia considers Russia, but not sort of old Russia. But now with this decision to launch these strikes into Kursk, on Monday, Vladimir Putin came out and enunciated a very new, updated nuclear response strategy. And in this included that any country that was supplying, that would be supplying Ukraine with weapons that were used to attack inside Russia, even if they were conventional weapons, but if it was in sufficient volume that it posed a critical threat, Russia would use, it would be doctrinally correct for them to use nuclear weapons. So that's where we are. They launched these six missiles on Monday into Kursk. Well, the Ukrainians did. Russia reportedly shot down at least five, if not six. Russia claims no significant damage. Ukraine claims, we caused all sorts of damage. The Ukrainians have a proven track record of lying, so I go with the Russian version. Then on Tuesday, they fired 12 more that were shot down. That's 18. So those run at roughly $1.2 million a pop. So, what you're looking at is, close to $2.2 million worth of missiles fired. $2 million worth of missiles fired. It accomplished nothing other than to elicit out of Russia and said, okay, we're going to respond. And overnight, we saw Russia deploy a medium-range ballistic missile that was equipped with a MIRV warhead. MIRV stands for Multiple Independent Reentry Vehicles, MIRV. So that means when the ballistic missile comes down, the warhead goes off and separates, and you got 5, 6, 7, 8 different potential bombs going down. Now, these could be, each of those could be a nuclear bomb, or they could be just a conventional warhead. In this case, Russia's using conventional warheads. There's some speculation that what they did last night was simply a demonstration to the West of saying, okay, cut this out or else this is where we're going. We could very easily find ourselves with the Russians deciding to attack all NATO military targets inside of Ukraine. And up to this point, they've really shied away from trying to inflict casualties on NATO. I think that's going to disappear. Now, they're going to inflict casualties. Possibility that they could strike outside of Ukrainian territory. Depends. It really depends on the nature of what transpires in the next 3 or 4 days. If Ukraine continues to fire at this rate, they're going to be out of missiles by the end of the week. There are no more attackers to send, no more to shoot. So it's a very dangerous time right now, because in addition to the U.S. authorizing the attackers, the Brits authorized the use of Storm Shadow missiles, same thing. And from the Russian standpoint now, they are treating this as they are at war with the United States, with the United Kingdom, with NATO, not just with Ukraine.
That only really leads me to my question. Is this a NATO attack, or is this provoked by the British? Because there were a British warhead, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, that was fired. So obviously Britain was involved. Or is this, and I just can't understand the insanity of it, is this a Harris-Biden trying to stir things up to make things irreparable for Trump?
Well, I've speculated that, it could be, at one end, it could be an effort by the Biden administration simply to sabotage Trump coming in. That Trump has said, I get the war settled in 24 hours, so therefore they're going to create a situation that will make it impossible to settle in 24 hours, so they can then say, see, Donald Trump is a liar. Another more sinister view, and I'm not necessarily suggesting this is true, but it's a possibility that has to be entertained, that the Biden administration wants to spark a war with Russia and or Iran or both in order to create a security situation, a threat situation of such enormity that they could justify postponing or preventing the inauguration of Donald Trump in January. Now, I don't think that's likely, but I think you have to consider that as a possibility, something that they're thinking about.
Okay, so I've thought about that as well, and this is pure speculation, but I think that that is possible. Can we work that out a little bit more? What would exactly happen? It's like, okay, we're at war, we're declaring war, and then...
Well, we could declare a state of emergency in the United States. We could even, something as unconstitutional as declare martial law to prevent the electors from going to Washington, D.C. to sit and to carry out their duty of confirming the election of Donald Trump, and therefore to actually try to create a situation where the government would continue under the control of Joe Biden and his administration. I raise that in terms of considering all the possibilities. I'm not necessarily convinced that that's the case. I think it's more likely that they're simply trying to sabotage Trump's ability to work to resolve the situation when he comes into office. But in their, they're driven by such a petty desire for revenge that they're going to actually cause something far greater than they even imagined. They never considered some of the possibilities of what they're unleashing here.
So let's pivot a little bit to the Middle East, not a little bit, a lot, to the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to also continually escalate, especially with, correct me, again, I want to make sure I get all my facts straight, with South Lebanon going in there, as well as with Iran. Is this the same kind of, if you would, entanglement, if you would, is to make it so entangled that it'd be so almost impossible to get out of? What's the motivation and where do you see this heading?
Well, actually, I think that this is one of the other areas to consider where the Biden administration is manufacturing a causus belli, a cause to go to war. So we found on November 8th, the FBI announced, oh, there was this assassination plot to kill Donald Trump. And they released the indictment of three people, one guy named Farhad Shakiri, another fellow Rivera, and the third was, I think, Lodefault. Well, I dug into that indictment and read through it. And basically, that whole thing was staged. It was a fabrication. This is one of those cases where the FBI goes out and tells somebody, hey, I think you need to consider killing this person over here. And, you know, we'll give you $10,000. You're like, $10,000, okay. All you got to do is follow this other person. Okay. Well, the individual they approached had no intention of killing the other person. They were just approached. They were incited to do it. When you read through this indictment, this character, Farhad Shakiri, is, in my view, and I've talked to friends, former FBI, senior FBI official, hostage rescue team, a CIA buddy who was a chief of station overseas in multiple locations, and a couple of buddies who worked with the Drug Enforcement Administration, all agree with me, this thing stinks. Because this Farhad Shakiri, born in Afghanistan in 1973, comes to the United States in 1979, 1980 as a small, you know, young kid, grows up in the States, never becomes an American citizen, gets picked up for armed robbery in 93, goes to prison in New York in 1994, is in prison for 14 years. 2008, he gets out. They immediately deport him to Afghanistan. So the next thing we know, Shakiri is in Sri Lanka in 2019 with one of these other individuals that's mentioned in the indictment. It goes by co-conspirator number one, CC-1. They get popped on trying to move 92 kilos of heroin. Now, I guarantee you in Sri Lanka, number one, the Sri Lankan narcotics police were working with DEA. In fact, DEA intelligence is probably what made this arrest possible. And in Sri Lanka, they, instead of, you know, putting these guys up against the wall and shooting them or putting them into prison, they don't do anything with them. Well, that right away, all my DEA guys said, they cut a deal. Yeah. When you get somebody with that kind of weight of an illegal substance, you get to come out and say, okay, let's make a deal. Give us your connects. You have to give up the people above you, become an informant. And they did. And then it's like 4 years later in 2023 that supposedly this Farhad Shakiri is now, here he is, a convicted robber, a felon in the United States, picked up on drug trafficking. But now he's in Iran working with an oil and gas job. Now, I don't know how much you know about Iran and the Islamic Republic, but they're not real keen on criminals, particularly Afghanis with a drug record, okay? And so this guy, Farhad, claims, oh, he was approached by someone from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Command, the IRGC, who said, hey, we want to have you do a job for us in the United States. We've got, this guy that ripped us off for $250,000. We want to get him killed. And so will you help us? And the IRGC guy's name supposedly is Soleimani. Well, that's convenient. And so what does Farhad Shaqiri do? Gets on the phone and calls up guys that he was in prison with 15 years ago. Want to make an extra 10 grand? I said, yeah, and you're going to kill these guys. And all of these conversations are recorded. Oh, gee, I wonder how the FBI knew to record them. And they had him send money. So they had all this documented evidence. I'll call it manufactured evidence or created for a purpose. Then the FBI, and this is in the indictment, they call this guy. They say, he's in Tehran. We're going to call him up and interview him. And so in the interview, he's talking all about his IRGC contacts and what he was doing with the Iranians. Now, he's supposedly in Iran. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Command has intercept capabilities. They monitor phone calls coming from the United States, just like our NSA monitors phone calls coming from Iran. And yet this guy's freely talking about it and is still alive to talk about it. This thing was entirely manufactured to create Iran's a terrible threat, and we need to be able to be prepared to go to war with him. That's all this was. So that's what I mean. This is, you've got a lot of different moving parts here. It's not just Ukraine. It's also trying to go to war with Iran. The United States is out of control.
Yeah. Okay. So let's work that out. Then the United States is out of control, and it seems like, and I keep on saying they, it seems like they want a war before the election. I mean, before the inauguration.
Yes.
And really, no, they, I know who they are in a broad sense, but I don't know who they are specifically. Gain me through this. What are the odds are? And I don't need, you don't even have to give me odds, but is this going to happen or what is it going to?
There are senior officials at the Department of Defense, Department of Justice, CIA, in particular, that are worried that they're going to get indicted, are worried that they have genuine legal exposure for their criminal activities. They want to buy some insurance. So the way to get insurance is to prevent Donald Trump from coming in and taking action. So I think they're prepared to do anything, up to and including starting a war, just to keep the Trump from coming after him. It's that bad. So they clearly have the motive. If we get into if they provoke a war, and the United States, the Russians decide to attack us here in the United States, attack a military base or attack Washington, D.C., It's going to throw the country into complete chaos. We've never experienced that at all since the War of 1812, where we've been attacked on this territory by a foreign government.
Okay, so it's going to be a really precarious time, really, from now until the inauguration here.
60 days.
We have 60 days, I guess. And so, what's another thing that we need to be aware of? Another missile attack by Ukraine, another Russia. Oh, and it didn't start attacking NATO targets or is this, Israel lobbing bombs at Iran?
No, I think we'll know in the next 24 hours, what's going to happen. Russia's been very clear. They're going to respond to this attack, but they're not going to be emotional about it. They're going to be very strategic, but they're going to also send a very clear message They're going to send a very clear message that they're not going to tolerate any more of these attacks and encroachment on Russian territory. So, I think what you need to consider is that the possibility of this escalating. When they hit a NATO target, the ball's going to be in their court. What are they going to do? And at that point, if NATO decides to try to up it with more conventional style attacks, then Russia's going to counter with even greater force. So then you're faced with these NATO countries having to back down if they want to keep from sending the world into a war that could literally destroy mankind. I mean, this is, like I said, it'd be one thing if we had some smart people in charge. We don't. Biden, Keir Starmer, Macron, they're imbeciles. They are the most shallow individuals, which have no strategic vision at all at heart.
Yeah. Okay. I'd certainly agree with you. It seems like all of our leaders are that way in all countries, and they just fail up, if you would. So just a very, very precarious time, to say the least, I would say. Really, that's all I have, and all my questions that I have, other than is just be very aware. And I really just don't know how this is going to play out. But
well, you've got some other interesting dynamics that have unfolded just overnight. The International Criminal Court, ICC, has issued arrest warrants for Bibi Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant, the former defense minister. It raises the possibility that if Netanyahu decides to travel, and he's not going to travel out of country, he could be arrested, and then they could be taken to the Hague, and they could face a criminal trial. It'll be interesting to see what sort of, the Netanyahu obviously is pushing back, yelling, screaming, hollering about this. You're going to get pushback as well within the United States, who will condemn the ICC, though they praised the ICC when they indicted Vladimir Putin, which was over really trumped up political charges of child trafficking, of all things, just ridiculous. But in the case of Israel, the charges of genocide are real, substantive, because Israel is murdering Palestinian people and Lebanese now. So this is going to introduce a new dynamic. You've got Israel bogged down essentially in southern Lebanon, as happened in 2006, when they went in and tried to push Hezbollah north of the Litani River. And Hezbollah is too well entrenched and too many well-defended and defensive positions. And Israel's just, it's like running into a brick wall with a car. They're crashing and they're destroying themselves in the process.
That's crazy to me, too. That's just crazy to me, too, that they're doing that.
Well, it's all part of this pursuit of the Zionist cause. And what's really sort of ironic about the whole concept of Zionism is these people insist that the people who do not believe in God, people who do not believe that Moses wrote the Pentateuch, the first five books of what the Christians call the Old Testament. People who don't believe that, however, believe that God gave this land to them according to the promises in the Pentateuch.
Wow.
Now, so they deny sort of the religious faith, but then they embrace the tenets of that faith to insist that, God gave us this land. And, this may sound a little controversial, but the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, written by Jews, for Jews, to tell a Jewish story from a Jewish perspective. And to pretend, and they want to pretend that it's God, a supreme being, who's playing favorites with them. It's nonsensical. And you get a glimpse of that. Just you go to Genesis, in one of the earliest chapters where God, supposedly there's this one supreme deity, God, and God is creating the earth and God's creating man. And then in this one passage, in this Jewish-produced scripture, now remember, the Jews say, there is no God but God, just like the Muslims. There is no God but God, monotheistic. They quote, with respect to, you know, once Adam and Eve have eaten of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, this passage says, and God says, man has become like us. Us? Who's God talking to? More than one? There's stuff like that in there that you go, wait a second. Your story's not hanging together. But out of that, they've created this mythology that they, the Jews, and this should not apply to all of Judaism, but the ones who embrace the Zionism the most ardently are convinced that God likes them better than other people. In fact, there are certain other people that God wants to destroy, the Amalek, and the Jews get to do that. And so,
yeah, it's really bad theology. It's really bad. It's really, really bad.
Yeah.
This is what I was going to ask you. Do you think things, and I do need to wrap it up, but do you think things will change with our relationship with Israel under a Trump administration?
Probably not. It may get worse. Trump has surrounded himself with a group of ardent Zionists. They're Christian Zionists, though. So they're not the same as the Anthony Blinkens and the Adam Hochsteins, the people who are actually Jewish and have a, you know, vested interest there. But Trump, you know, Trump also is a pragmatic deal maker.
Right.
And he may have paid off Miriam Adelson by promoting or nominating all of these pro-Zionist personalities, Marco Rubio, Michael Waltz, into his cabinet, Tulsi Gabbard. But in terms of actual policy, he may pursue something differently, particularly if he sees Israel destroying itself.
Yeah, which they are.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
Well, Larry, how can people find you? I'm a big fan of your work. How can people find you? And I will link to everything.
Sonar21.com. They can find me there and with all the links.
Larry, again, I've had you on. It's always a pleasure and really love your perspective and your insight. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.